to their roots and to their ancestors, and they are encountering this. And he's still pushing through because this is, you know, he's trying to fix what his predecessors didn't do.
Well, they are doing what perhaps what we thought was behind closed doors in terms of a genocide. We thought that some of the statements that we're hearing now is not what was said before, and that right now is when they are coming out in the open day, meaning the Israeli officials. But from what I read through over here, it seems like the genocidal statements was there from way back. For example, you said that there's a new discourse that has arisen, frustrated by Palestinian resilience. This is something that you said, and that was especially after a massive natural gas field was discovered off the northern Gaza, worth trillions of dollars. For example, you mentioned Colonel Ephraim Eitan, who said in 2004, quote, "We have to kill them all." Aaron Sofer, so-called intellectual and political advisor. Again, things that you covered in your speech, that we have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. And then fast forward to today, in 2025, Minister of Social Equality and Women's Advancement, May Galan of Likud. "I am personally proud of the ruins of Gaza and that every baby, even 80 years from now, will tell their grandchildren what Jews did." So what we are seeing, this genocide play out, as people are now well aware of the term, in real time.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, when I was in Gaza, when I was, you know, looking around at utterly bewildered, and this was still in 2024, and it has gotten infinitely worse. But when I was there, looking around at people who were just utterly bewildered, disheveled, hygiene was a problem because of lack of water. Israel bombed all the water resources. And I kept remembering this quote by Raphael Eitan. Also, I think he said this in the 80s, I think 86 perhaps, I can't remember. But he said, when we have settled all the land, all the Arabs will be able to do will be to scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. Reducing and degrading Palestinians has been a long time Zionist fantasy. And I think that's what they're doing. There is this deep jealousy that they have of the people who truly possess the roots that they covet in the land. They resent the fact that despite their siege, despite the constant bombing that they've done over the years, Palestinians in Gaza still managed to create a beautiful life, to build, you know, everybody, they keep saying, oh, Palestinians could have built, they could have done this, but actually they did. There were beautiful cafes, even with such limited resources. Palestinians kept education as a premium. There were multiple universities throughout Gaza, and people still sought advanced degrees, medical degrees, PhDs, master's degrees, architectural degrees, art degrees. They hate that. They hate that. They think that we are supposed to be, as one Zionist said, waiters and woodcutters. They, in the Zionist imagination, we are meant to be a cheap labor force. Mm-hmm. How dare us become professionals? How dare us be writers and creatives and intellectuals? How dare us have modern buildings and cultural institutions and writing salons and museums? And how dare us? They cannot abide that. And it is no accident that Israel, one of the first places they went after were the universities. They particularly occupied the universities and then detonated them. We've all seen the footage of soldiers detonating the Islamic University of Gaza, Al-Azhar University. every single institution of higher learning has been utterly decimated.
Well, the things that you're talking about are so shocking, and it really brings me when you I was listening to you, wondering. Well, you speak eloquently about what has happened. You really depict a picture that is out there that is not only not covered as much as it should, but rather misunderstood because the West, in particular, generally speaking, and in particular their media organizations, obviously want to change the narrative against some of the things that you have said. I'm wondering if there was enough coverage the way you just described the realities, whether we would be looking at a different landscape, although I think that the landscape has changed in terms of the views that people generally have on the Israeli regime.
So absolutely. I mean, Western media have largely acted as stenographers for Israel. And if you look at the owners and the advertisers and the editors at these media outlets, they are Zionist ideologues in large part. Sometimes they're even Mossad agents, as the head of the Middle Eastern bureau of the BBC, for example. That has been a big scandal, and he's still there. He's still deciding the coverage of what's happening. But however, the difference now is that there are other media outlets that are accessible to the West, and so it becomes harder to gatekeep information. Media outlets like yours, like Press TV, Electronic Intifada, and so many other independent media outlets and journalists who have been covering this with a conscience and with fact and truth. I think, however, in general, across the board, people tend to focus on this moment in isolation. Even, you know, it's kind of, you know, people generally start with October 7. And even though there are a lot, some media outlets have pushed back and said this goes back to 48, I think it's important to view this in a much larger frame, not just Palestinian history, but the history in the region, to look at the kind of propaganda that Zionists have promulgated. Even if you look at Iraq, for example, the way the misinformation, the propaganda, the way that media outlets lined up just, you know, to as stenographers for Israel, despite an iota of evidence to destroy and dismantle one of the oldest civilizations in the world.
Indeed.
To reduce a high-functioning, frankly, glorious society, even under a dictator. Iraq was glorious. It was stunning. And they have utterly dismantled it. They have broken the backbone of the society, their intellectuals, their writers, their teachers, their doctors and engineers, and created utter despair and chaos that has persisted and will persist for generations before they can. And this was engineered by Israel. Remember this history, but we lived it. People my age remember it very well. The way that across the board, the Washington Post, the New York Times, they just repeated Israeli lies that Saddam was developing nuclear weapons, just like they were trying to do with Iran recently, by the way. That Iraq was developing nuclear weapons and they already had weapons of mass destruction. And despite the evidence, despite the UN nuclear watchdog indicating like there's no such thing, there's no evidence. And to the point that they had Zionists sent Netanyahu himself to speak before Congress, and there's that famous clip, I think, you know, most people have seen it, where he says, "I guarantee you that taking out Saddam Hussein will bring peace."
Right, yes,
he said,
indeed.
And he said, there is no doubt whatsoever that he's trying to develop nuclear weapons. And he's this close. This was another war that Israel pushed the United States into fighting on their behalf. So I think we have to take it in the context of the propaganda that they utilize. And they're doing that in Gaza as well. But also, like, even beyond the region, if you look in a historical sense, right, let's take two moments. For example, the Nat Turner Uprising. Nat Turner was an enslaved man who led a slave rebellion against their enslavers, and it was brutal. He butchered everybody, every white person he saw, right? And so, and just like, and, at the, and I mean, this is a very old script, and just like they're doing right now, starting history at October 7th, and pointing to Palestinians as being so savage and untrustworthy and violent and irrational. They did the same thing. It was the same kind of propaganda back then, and they slaughtered dozens, hundreds actually, of enslaved black people to teach people a lesson.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to have you, Susan Abulhawa. Thank you so much. And we heard some of your dog there.
Thank you.
And I'm sure it contributed to this program as well. But really insightful statements that you made there made for a truly great exchange. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Well, that does it for this edition of Unscripted. So much to unpack there from what our guest there, Susan, said, in terms of all the different things that you probably may not have heard of. From Mikabe Tawai and the team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye until the next program.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Stay with us. Straightly, we go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine, and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. We start off this hour's lineup with dialogue. The program looks at the most important conversations between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of other Islamic faith and sects. They will be followed by Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Leader's Speech. The program presents an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay with us for the next hour.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And his eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we have a very interesting conversation and a dialogue that the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, has with one of his companions. In the era of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we find this kind of a pseudo-spirituality that had become quite prevalent in His Eminence's age. Now, of course, this pseudo-spirituality, this pseudo-asceticism and zuhud had come about because the people had strayed from the original path of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, as well as the previous five divinely appointed imams. And so when we get to the era of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we find that this pseudo-spirituality has spread amongst the Muslims, and in many times they were teachings and a kind of spirituality that was quite far removed from the original pure Muhammadan Islam. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, of course, amongst the many thousands of things that His Eminence did and dealt with and spoke about during his imamah and his leadership, of course, were these kind of moral and ethical teachings. And it's interesting that the moral and ethical teachings and the pseudo-spirituality that was going around, it was very superficial. There was not a lot of depth or profound meaning behind, these pseudo-spiritual teachings that were going around amongst the people. In one situation, to one of his companions, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he talks about the tongue. And so it was a very interesting conversation because His Eminence says that one should accustom or habituate their tongue to only say good things. And when you habituate your tongue to only say good things, you will end up gaining and benefiting from it. And he continues and he says that your tongue is easily habituated and accustomed to what you want it to do and what you want it to perform. And so it becomes accustomed to receive whatever you give to it, whether it is good or it is bad. So you should consider what you accustom your tongue to. So it's just, a very powerful piece of spiritual advice here, right? So the tongue, of course, connected to the heart or the inner eye, or connected to our spirituality, right? We speak the truth, we recite the Holy Quran, we recite the traditions of the infallibles and immaculates, alayhim assalam. And there's a lot of positive things that we can do with our tongue. We can stand up for truth and justice. We can promote truth and justice. We can expose lies. We can stand up for the downtrodden, defend the downtrodden, bring rational and reasonable proofs to be able to promote and spread the pure Muhammadan Islam. We can stand up against oppression. And really, ultimately, the more you think about it, you realize a lot of these things are happening via the tongue. So if we use the tongue for good, then, well, we're going to benefit from it. But if, God forbid, we use the tongue for bad, then we will only incur harm and loss, not only in this world, but in the next as well. This is Dialogue, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
So this concept that the Prophet left two things for guidance. One is the Quran and the other is the Ahlul Bayt. The Quran was there, but even the Ahlul Bayt were there, always present to give guidance alongside the Quran wherever the Muslims sought their guidance. And by the time of the fifth Imam, as I said, that distinction between the Amma and Khassa was becoming very blurry, actually, sometimes. And so there was a need to clearly draw the line that this is the Shi'i point of view, especially when it came to the many burning issues of those days, that the Imams wanted their followers to know what is the Shi'i perspective. One of the things that the Imams did was actually train their companions, and I'm using the words Imam here for Sadiqain, both Imam Muhammad al-Baqir as well as Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, because they basically together did it, although the opportunity and the impact of the sixth Imam is more than his father in that way. We see very clearly that, you know, both the fifth and sixth Imam, in a very planned manner and in an intense manner, trained and educated their companions. These were not only companions of the Imam, they were actually ulama, trained by the Imam in all different, disciplines, whether it is theology, or you're talking about tafsir, or you're talking about fiqh, when we talk about Arabic grammar and hadith issues, all these issues, you know, Imams actually have identified disciples and the companions, and they realize, okay, this one has this capability, you know, so they would basically train that fellow in that one discipline more than the other. And so then we have talked about some of this, stories before, where a person came from Sham and, you know, he said, I would like to have a debate with you, to the Imam, sixth Imam. And he said, okay, what is the subject on which you want to have a debate? So he brought up a subject and he pointed to his companion. He says, you know, you sit down with him. And once they finished, and it's interesting that Imam is sitting there. You know, this is where the teacher is now training the students, and even observing how they are conducting themselves. And then he said, okay, now I want to go into another subject. So Imam doesn't say continue with him. He says, now, you know, have a discussion with this of, my disciple. And so it shows that they had trained them in different ways. And this is the sixth Imam, long before the era of the, ghibat. You know, so sometimes when we talk about this issue, the process of ijtihad and things like that, you know, this all started after the ghibat of the Imam. They don't realize that the planning and the training and the work started from early eras, especially from the days of the fifth and the sixth Imam. Because even after that, you have 11 Imams who were there in the community. Yet, you know, there were ulama around them, trained by them. And that was the basically preparing this ground for the era where the Imam would not be accessible to the community.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome. This is IRIB English Radio and you're listening to Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer questions, queries that are related to the Islamic upbringing of the children, and the answers are given by the experts who have a specialization in the similar field. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Brother Liaqat is a research scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and our answers are based upon the Holy Book of Quran and the Hadith from Prophet Muhammad. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family. And also the narrations from noble imams. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. Well, in the previous episode, you told us that it is the lack of knowledge. It is a lack of ma'rifah towards the Prophet, towards the Imams, that keeps us away from obedience. So I would want you to continue today. How is it? Could you expand more on that?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So, example, I would say, I don't know a person. I've just heard about him that he's a good person. That's it. And it's been told to me from my childhood that I have to love that person, and I love that person. So I would say subconsciously and back of my mind, I know that I love a certain person.
Right.
Okay. So okay.
But why you don't know?
But why I don't know about that person as well? I don't know much about him.
Right.
Okay, I just know that okay, he's a good one, and I really kind of have inclination towards him.
Right.
And whatever he says should be obeyed. Example. Okay.
Right.
This is the example when it comes to the lives of the imams, alayhim assalam. If I ask a teen, example. I ask him about the life of Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself, okay, except for the martyrdom and maybe a few points here and there.
Right.
A person doesn't know much about Imam Hussein right. alayhi salam as well. Even about Imam Ali alayhi salam. I would ask about those 25 years after the shahadat of Rasulullah, after
right.
the martyrdom of Rasulullah. What do you know about Imam Ali alayhi salam? 25 years is a lot. Is a lot.
Yes.
About Amirul Mu'mineen, the successor of Rasulullah, do we really know much about him? Is a question. Okay. Just because I love Imam Ali alayhi salam and I obey him, that's okay. That's a good point. Okay. But the thing is not sufficient. I'm lacking something in myself.
Okay.
I have to look into myself. And you know, when a person knows the opposite person, the more he knows, the more the inclination rises, the more the inclination rises, the more the obedience towards the person and his words will increase. Example, what happens in addiction is a question, right? Example, in addiction, what happens is a person in the first place doesn't have any kind of
knowledge.
Inclination about it, okay?
Right.
Example, there's alcohol. I would say a person who never drank alcohol, do you have inclination towards alcohol?
No.
The person will say, definitely no. Okay? But when he drinks it, he gets the knowledge of alcohol. I'm just giving an example, okay? So when he drinks, he gets an inclination towards it. The more he drinks, the more he gets addicted, okay? This is about the bad things, okay?
If we can give a very tangible example today, it's especially for the teenagers, it's Social media. They are into the apps or scrolling without any purpose and for hours there, and they are there because they entered it.
Exactly. The reason I have taken an example of something which is haram is because even if a person who is a Shia, okay, I have spoken to a few people who are Shias and unfortunately who drink alcohol. And I spoke to them and asked them about the reason of why they are still drinking alcohol. Few amongst them told me a surprising answer. They were like, they don't want to, but they can't stop drinking. You see, they don't want to drink alcohol. The same goes with all the haram activities as well. Like there are a few teens who want to stop committing haram acts, but they cannot. Why? Because they got in a way inclined towards it. They got addicted towards it. Okay.
Right.
So this is the bad part, like getting inclined towards haram activities. And there's a good part as well, getting inclined towards the good activities or good deeds as well.
Now let's talk about good part, but after a short break, dear listeners, stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadeer.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Brother Liaquat is here with us in the studio. We're talking about the inclination, how teens get inclined to different things. Here, Brother Liaquat said that I gave a few examples of bad inclinations, and now we are about to talk about good things.
Perfect. So about the good inclinations example, a person, what the best example what is given over here, I would say, according to me, of course, is about namaz. A person doesn't have the habit of reciting namaz, okay? So it is told to the person that, you know what, go ahead, recite namaz for one day, okay? Recite namaz for the second day, recite namaz for the third day, for the fourth day, for the fifth and sixth. And on the seventh day, you will see the namaz pulling you towards itself.
All right.
Yes. So after a point, a point will come in his life, maybe on the 10th day, maybe on the 15th day, whatever. Maybe in just 4 or 5 days, a point will come in his or her life that he cannot live without reciting namaz. It would be like, I know people who cried near me just because they missed their Fajr Salah. They couldn't wake up because of the previous night for whatever reason. They got tired and they slept very late for whatever reason. And they, because they just missed their Salah, not intentionally, unintentionally, they couldn't wake up. They cried like anything. And there was Shuhada as well.
Right.
In this line, who used to cry, oh my God, one namaz of mine became qaza. How is it possible? You see?
Right.
So they cannot bear this thing. This is a good inclination.
Because there's this knowledge that, you know, when you miss namaz, actually, there's nothing that can actually, you know, overcome this.
Yeah, it cannot recompensate like that particular namaz, you see.
Yes.
Anyway, so this is about namaz and the other actions as well. Now coming to the obedience of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Actually, this is a skill. Making a teen or making oneself inclined towards the obedience of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. It is a skill, just like namaz. Just like namaz. The thing which stops as example is about the knowledge. One of the things.
Right.
I'm not saying this is the whole reason. Okay. Oh, you know what? Someone who doesn't have knowledge about Ahlul Bayt will not obey Ahlul Bayt. This is not what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
There are people who don't have knowledge about Ahlul Bayt. Example, how they are, and example, how they live their life, but they still do obey. Yeah, they are true lovers and they do obey the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, whatever they say. They are really particular about their Islamic duties, okay?
Hey, you're trying to say that the more knowledge that adds to you,
yeah,
helps you connect.
Definitely, it will help us more. And of course, it's vice versa as well. There are vice versa places where a person knows about the Ahlul Bayt, but still he disobeys them. And there are other reasons, like why is a person knowing the Ahlul Bayt and still is disobeying them. One of the best examples of what we see is on the day of Ashura. There were people from the enemy's side who knew the Ahlul Bayt, who knew properly, like clearly, oh, he is the grandson of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And they knew about his maqamah, his status as well. But still, they went against him.
Yeah.
They went against him, they martyred him as well.
Right.
Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. And of course, about Amir al-Mu'mineen, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people who knew who Amir al-Mu'mineen was. But they still went against Imam Ali alayhi salam. And there are reasons, of course.
Right. So here, one thing is clear. Having less knowledge about Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is not something that you're never going to love them. And having more knowledge about them is, again, not something that you're going to be completely obedient. What gets clear over here is that, however, if you have a marifat, actual marifat about them, will definitely increase your inclination towards them. We'll explore that more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaqat is here with me in the studio. And we're talking about obedience for teenagers. And Brother Liaqat, hey again.
Yes, sister. So I was saying, actually, this is a kind of complicated topic. Why does a person know about the Ahlul Bayt, but still he goes against them? Why does a person doesn't know about the Ahlul Bayt, but still he obeys them? Okay. Of course, the true love towards them plays a vital role, okay? And no matter how it goes, the first teaching what a parent has to do towards his child is about the love towards the Holy Quran, the love towards the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu was-salam. Why? Because if a person has love towards some person, okay? Example, the Ahlul Bayt over here. The love itself is going to pull the person towards them.
The way you said namaz is going to
go. Exactly. Over here, example, we have a hadith from Imam Rida alayhi salam, where he says, Man kana minna wa lam yut illa falaysa minna. Where he says, whoever says that he is from us, from amongst us, wa lam yut illa, but doesn't obey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, falaysa minna. He's not from us. He's not from us, meaning he shouldn't be considering amongst Ashias or also the Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim. There are few people who are counted amongst the Ahlul Bayt. Of course, not those 14, of course, infallibles. Like example, Salman. Okay.
Yeah.
Salmanu minna Ahlul Bayt, which is a very famous hadith from the Prophet. Yeah. Example. Okay. So coming back to the topic, when a person has this love towards the Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim, the person gets inclined to know about them and also to obey them. This is one of the fundamental rules. What if a person has love towards the Ahlul Bayt and doesn't have an inclination towards knowing them more or increasing in their ma'rifah? This is where a person like a parent or an educator should find, oh, this is a problem. Why is there, example, I have love towards, playing basketball.
Right.
Okay. I know how to play basketball, but I don't go towards playing basketball. Okay. So there is some issue. Why am I not going? If playing is good and
sports is
good.
So there's something wrong with you.
There is something wrong. I don't know. There's some issue in
me. That has to be sorted out.
Yeah, exactly. So the parent or the educator, if the parents are not helping out, the teenager should take a responsibility upon himself or herself to find the issue. Okay, if I love the Ahlul Bayt, why am I not going towards learning about them?
Right.
Because the more I'm going to learn about them, the more I'm going to obey them.
Right. And obeying Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam is actually obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care of yourself. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Heroes of the 8-year Holy Defense. Dear listeners, welcome to our special series on the occasion of the Holy Defense Week, marking start of the 8-year war imposed in 1980 by the US through its agent Saddam of the tyrannical Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad in a bid to overthrow the newly established Islamic Republic. This nefarious plot, however, was foiled by the astute leadership of the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, who instilled in the Iranians the spirit of jihad and sacrifice to emerge victorious. Today, we will dwell on the soaring spirit of another pilot, in fact, the pilot of a fighter aircraft, Abbas Babai, who achieved martyrdom while serving Islam and the Islamic Republic. Stay with us, please. As we said in our previous editions, during the 8 years of Holy Defense, the Islamic Republic of Iran was facing the might of almost the whole world. In addition to the weaponry supplied to Saddam by the capitalist West and communist East, the repressive Ba'ath minority regime was funded and financed to the tune of scores of billions of dollars by the reactionary Arab regimes, especially the spurious British-created entity called Saudi Arabia. It was thus faith in Islam and the teaching of the Prophet and his infallible Ahlul Bayt that inspired Iran's Muslim combatants to foil the intricate plot of the enemies of humanity. One such intrepid defender of the country was Abbas Babai, who was born in a religious family in Ghazvin in 1950 and after schooling joined the Air Force. In the pre-revolution days, Iran was a client state of the Great Satan, that is US, and American experts and military advisors did not allow Iranians to completely master the skills for maintenance and repair of airplanes. Even the Iranian cadets dispatched to the US for training were not given proper training. Yet, in spite of these restrictions, Abbas Babai, who was sent to the US for training, devoted himself to the mastering of the techniques of operating fighter planes, especially F-14. A pious man, Abbas Babai, during his training years in the US, took extra care against being influenced by the decadent Western culture. He used to avoid all unclear foods and drinks and regularly observed his religious rites and rituals. On return to Iran, he became a pilot of Northrop F-5 and trained under McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom II and Grumman F-14 Tomcat. He married his cousin Maliheh and was based in Khuzestan province when the Islamic Revolution triumphed. He joined the revolutionaries and vowed to devotedly serve the ideals of the Islamic Republic. When the war started, Abbas Babai enthusiastically carried out whatever operations that were entrusted to him. Martyr Abbas Babai was a great man who was raised in the school of martyrdom. He was a fighter whose piety and devotion was a byword. He was a virtuous man whose soul was filled with love, selflessness, and generosity. A soldier who was a brave veteran of battlefields and a great fighter against his own carnal desires. He used to secretly provide financial help to the needy persons, especially colleagues who were from poor families. In 1981, the 31-year-old Abbas Babai, as head of the Air Base Islamic Society, was made commander of the 8th Air Force Base. After showing his competence and his commitment while serving as the commander of Isfahan Air Base, in 1983 he was appointed as the deputy head of Air Force Operation and transferred to Tehran. Abbas Babai, with over 3,000 hours of air flights with different types of jet fighters, spent most of his time in operational fights and war fronts in the west and south of Iran. From 1985 until his martyrdom in 1987, he carried out over 60 war missions with full success. For the speedy progress of operations, he did not limit himself to supervision, but he always took part in war missions to become aware of problems and probable risks. In view of his competence and bravery, he was promoted as Brigadier General in 1987, a few weeks before his martyrdom. While returning from a mission, Abbas Babai was hit by an Iraqi air defense system and martyred. In the morning of Eid al-Adha, he and his co-pilot took off in a F-5 training plane from the Tabriz airbase and entered Iraq's airspace. After conducting a successful mission, his plane was hit and he sustained injuries. Although the co-pilot managed to land the aircraft, Abbas Babai achieved martyrdom.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016, Imam Khamenei. The first thing that the Islamic Republic did was to capture the Zionist center in Tehran, which was in control of the previous regime, and to expel them from the country, and then it gave the center to Palestinians. This was a true and symbolic course of action, and we have been continuing this position till today. We supported Palestine, we helped the Palestinians, and we will continue to do so. We have no considerations on this matter. The entire world of Islam should